I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
Hey guys, it's Talitha from Vine Wine. 750 has been the greatest revolution to wine buying in the last 10 years. The ability to be able to go online, search out one item, a Palo Cortado, a new cider, some Chinon, and have all of the answers and the great bottles in front of you in 2 seconds is something that has changed my life. Makes buying easier. I'm able to create lists late at night of wines that I've just tasted that I want to buy later. I'm able to search out wines from new importers that I've never even heard of. I'm able to find crazy stuff from Czechoslovakia that I didn't even know I wanted. You should be on 750. It's the way to be.
Fritz Weininger on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Really wonderful to have you here.
It's my pleasure.
So these days you make wine from the Vienna region. Mm-hmm. How did your family settle there, and what's the history?
Well, I'm born into a family that had over a long time and many generations to do with wine, but never in a big size. My forefathers had smaller wine producing farms, more or less farms, with actually we call it mixed farming system, where they had a little bit of agriculture, they had a little bit of apple trees, they had a little bit of cows and a few pigs, and most of their production was for themselves. And a little bit of wine always was left over, so they opened their living room, invited some guests, they bought some wine, drank some wine, had some fun, and my family had some money to buy things they were not able to produce themselves, like shoes or clothes or whatever they needed.
People would come to the house.
Yeah, people came to the house. It was either inside, like a living room that was cleared and some tables were put in, or it was in the garden, like in the summertime. Even today, it's wonderful to sit at those Heurigers, it's called today, sit outside. It's casual, no tablecloth, and you just sit down. You don't have to order food. You just order a glass of wine, maybe a bottle of water to it, and chat, communicate. And yeah, you drink a glass of wine. Maybe you get hungry then. Then you order something to eat, a little snack. Maybe some cream cheese and black bread. And yeah, with the food, you get thirsty. And with the wine, you get hungry. And this is a nice way to spend an afternoon or even an evening.
So this is a tradition in Vienna where people would welcome others to their home rather than a more formal restaurant.
Yeah, this is a mix. This is not just home. This is like you make a restaurant out of your home for a part time, like for 2 weeks. And after 2 weeks, you've sold enough wine and made enough money to buy the things you want. And then you close. And then it's your living room again. It's not happening today that way anymore, but it was 50, 100 years ago. And that was the way my forefathers made their living.
A lot of times we hear with Austrian wine market that the Austrians drink the wines quite young. I wonder if that tradition of drinking in the house of the grower shortly after the wine is bottled might have played into that desire or tradition of the greater region to drink wines fairly young.
That has for sure something to do with it, because the wine at the Heuriger is called Heuriger, and Heuriger means the wine of the last harvest. There's also a law to that. So as a Heuriger, you can only sell a wine that is from the last harvest until the 31st of December of the following year. So right after the next harvest, it's over with the Heuriger. And that means it always has to be a fairly young wine. Maybe in the older days, it was not as young as today because of the lack of filtration and techniques and so on. But today, with all the technologies, it's much easier to prepare a wine right after fermentation to make it look nice, to make it taste good, and you are able to sell it. People in Vienna especially, but actually all over Austria, love young white wines a lot. A lot more than we as the winemakers like to see that, because often the wine is drank away before the wine had the chance to develop fully as we would like to have it. So we are not happy with that, but you cannot change everything. This is is not easy for us.
And your mother was from a family of, that had Herreg.
Yeah, right. My mom was from a family. My grandfather had the Heuriger, as my great-grandfather had it. And she was the only daughter. She was growing up there. Actually, my mom is even an engineer of enology, one of the first women at her time in the early 1960s. She graduated a winemaking college. And shortly later, she met my father, who comes out of a small winery, a family-driven winery in the north of Vienna, towards the borderline to Czechia. Today it's Czechia. At that time, it was Czechoslovakia. A little cooler region, a region dedicated to Grüner Veltliner, a region dedicated to very fruity, very spicy types of wines. Exactly that type of wine in the east of Austria, especially in Vienna, we love to drink.
What are the growing conditions in Vienna?
Vienna is a little warmer than these northern regions. Vienna is kind of in the middle of the climate zones of Austria. North of Vienna, the influence of the Bohemian plate, a higher elevated region that starts in Austria but goes all over to towards to Prague in Czechia, that is very much lower in temperature because it's higher elevated. So there is influence from there. And on the other side, towards the east, southeast, is the Hungarian flatlands. And that brings a lot of warm air up to our region. Occasionally from the south, there is also an additional Mediterranean influence, but mainly, it's a game between the north and the cold north stream and this eastern warm air stream, and Vienna is right in between. So I always like to say Vienna is actually cool enough for fruity white wines, but still warm enough for dark and good structured red wines. And the fact that the Danube crosses Vienna, and actually the Danube crosses exactly the two major wine-growing regions in Vienna, the Biesenberg on the left-hand side of the Danube and the Nussberg on the right-hand side of the Danube. There's also humid microclimate, especially in the late summer or early fall, where it's not every year, but every second or third year, also possible to produce a very interesting botrytis sweet wines.
That's a range of production that you cover, because you make dry white wines and you make red wines and you make a little sweet wine, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I cover actually everything. It's also a lot of fun to not just concentrate on one specific style of wine. I couldn't imagine only making, I don't know, gemischter Satz or only Grüner Veltliner. It's fun to have also some sweet wines. It's fun to have some Pinot Noir and some Zweigelt. And well, as it is fun to have many different courses for your dinner, and with our styles of wines, we can accompany even a 7 or 10 course dinner from the aperitif up to the dessert.
You were born in 1966, and what was it like growing up with your parents?
Well, it was different than today, of course. There was no computer and no these modern things. I even was not in the kindergarten. We are two brothers. And we were playing with our parents in the vineyards. They were working in the vineyards. And we were playing cowboy and Indian and having a lot of fun out there with lots of nature. Actually, when I started to go to school with 6 or 72, everything changed a little bit. We moved completely to Vienna. Before, we partly lived in outside of Vienna in the north. And then we actually grow up at the Heuriger, because we lived in the middle of the Heuriger, and in the 70s it still was used that people drink a lot of wine and party, well, maybe not all night long, but half night long. They didn't walk out before they didn't drink 2 liters of wine, and it was 2 or 3 in the morning until my parents were able to go to bed, and my small brother and me, we were sleeping there. It was loud, there was music, there were people were dancing on the tables. It was wild, still wild. I still remember that times. It completely changed. Today it's almost the opposite. It's so different to those days.
Did the wines that were being consumed change as well during that period of time? Have tastes shifted since those years?
I think so, yes, definitely. It was more about a classic style of wine. The climate was cooler those days. Well, I'm more than 25 years now in the business, and I can definitely say there is a climate change. The 1980s, when I started to make wine, that was much cooler. The wines were lighter. The wines had more freshness and more acidity, sometimes that much acidity that it almost did hurt a little bit. That is not existing anymore these days. The 2000s and the 2010 vintages are completely different to that. My father had a conservative style. He made lots of his wines, or most of his wines, in big barrels from old oak. The oak didn't taste anymore. There was no temperature control. There was no yeast. There was no technology, actually. He waited the proper time, and once he thought the wine is stable and is developed enough, then the wine was bottled. When I started in the late 80s, I was trained a different style, and I wanted to do everything the opposite way. Stainless steel and temperature control and no spontaneous yeast. We control everything. We control the fermentation, we control the temperature, we control almost everything.
And you had gone to school in Austria?
Yes. And actually, the wines were very successful, but the longer I was into this, the less I was happy. And I moved more and more towards actually what my father did. Today, I'm doing it much more after the principles of my father than I did it in my beginnings. And I'm happy with this. This is also I see it as an evolution process for myself, more for my private person, for my own taste, that I had to go through this. Maybe in the beginning it was also a question of a generation conflict a little bit. I mean, my father and me, we always understood each other very good, but still he's my father, and there is always a little bit of conflict and a little bit of something you want to show him that you are better. And this changing many things was for me the possibility to show him that I also know about things maybe he did not know, and this is more the modern way, and he made the conservative way, and okay, he accepted and he respected that, but I have to respect that actually he did it the right way already at his time, and I am coming back to that today, and I'm happy that I found this way.
Did you ever talk to him about that? About coming back?
Sure, yeah.
What did he say? I was right the whole time, now pay me.
No, not that, but he likes to see that, of course, because he sees that his work was not that bad, and he likes this respect, of course. I never was respectless in front of him. I don't think so, at least. But I had my own style, and even today or 10 years ago, whenever we discussed a wine, you know, there is always more than one road that leads you to a city or to an interesting wine. And of course, I also could have gone a different direction technology-wise, or from the acid management or fermentation management, temperature management, whatever. But it is at the end of the day, not since 10 years, it's for longer, it is my signature on the wine, and people expect something when they buy my wine, so I have to go my style. And of course it's changing, but I cannot always listen to somebody, even when it's my father, but I cannot listen always to somebody else what I should do. I have to go my way. I do go my way. I'm most of the time happy with what I'm doing. I'm not always happy with what I'm doing. I'm very critical with my work, but I think it's necessary to also make mistakes. You learn out of mistakes and you develop your style and your way. And this is what I did over the last 25 years.
What were some of the markers or indications to you that you wanted to continue to evolve, perhaps back closer to your father? What were some of the things that were happening that made you think, oh, you know, maybe all of this control and stainless steel is not what I want?
The fruit intensity was very important for me in my beginnings. But I saw that the fruit disappears. And what stays is a thin wine, because the technology that leads to fruit is not building up structure in the wine. The second thing is acidity. High acidity is something that fits more or less to my region, especially 25 years ago when the climate was much cooler than it is today. But it was more for the local consumption, because the local people were used to it. The more we started to export and to meet other societies, other tastes, the more we found out the acidity is internationally much too extreme. This is not good. And also on the other side, often when it's even for us, it was too intense from the acidity. Let's say it's too sour, we said to some of the consumers, let's wait a year or two. You will see it will integrate. It will get more harmonious. Just wait 1-2 years. And I waited also 1-2 years. And what I saw was the fruit was gone. The acidity was even more intense. It didn't get better. That made me, of course, to see acidity management different. It's more about an earlier harmony today than it was in the late 1980s or early 1990s.
So less reductive work in the cellar, and thus a little bit more age in the cellar before release, and a little more exposure to oxygen.
Yeah, today I try to divide my program of wines into the entry level. Those wines, especially our market, really loves to have young. And the other group of the single vineyards, old wines, and those more representative styles, that are bottled later, that are also then bottled later when I'm sold out with the previous vintage. I don't care, because I really want to give those wines the time. But these lighter styles, some of them are on many wine lists. People want it young anyway, so we start to bottle as soon as the previous vintage is sold, or as soon as I think I can go with this quality in that stage, that I don't have to be have a bad feeling about it, to bottle it that early. Depends on the vintage, depends on the variety, depends on the style of wine, of course. At the end of the day, also this is my decision if I bottle it or not. It's not the not to make business. It's the business comes with the successful product you bottle. Because if it's good, then it sells and then it's business. So never bottle it early just to make money. This is not the right solution, not my way.
But I do find those two levels of wine very different from your winery. Mm-hmm. When I taste the wines that are bottled earlier, there's a real directness, a clarity of flavors, a refreshing character. Especially I think of the rosé is very refreshing. And then when I try like the Neusberg Alte Reben, that's a very different kind of wine, also labeled quite differently with a different style of label.
Yeah.
Do you find a significantly different market for those? I mean, does one play in one area of consumer and another in another? Or is it about proper age for the Alte Reben, or what works?
No, it's a different market also. It's these entry-level wines go much more to more regular restaurants and often are sold by the glass. It is really the regular Austrian consumer that asks for these wines. The pricing is also reasonable, so people can afford it. It's not so expensive.
But the Alte Reben's really not expensive either. I mean, comparatively for how old it is.
Yeah, compared to these entry-level wines, it's much more expensive. These regular consumers wouldn't take it. But not just because of the price, also because of the taste. Neusberg Alte Reben is a very good example, because this is really exactly the opposite. It is an extreme wine. It is a wine for sommeliers. It's a wine for top restaurants that know how to match it with the food. It's a wine for wine geeks, freaks, and wine producers, also enologists. They like this wine because it's so different, it's so unique, and it's so strongly dedicated to the, or influenced by the terroir of the Nussberg.
And what about that term that you mentioned before, gemischter Satz? What does that mean?
The gemischter Satz is a wine type that consists from different grape varieties that are planted together in one vineyard. By the law, it has to be at least three different grape varieties. But when we look at our old vineyards, it's usually way more. It's 6 to 10, 12. Sometimes I saw vineyards with 15, 16 different grape varieties. They are completely interplanted, mixed over the field, and they are harvested at the same time. So there is not everything mature at the same time. But this is the magic thing to a gemischter Satz. There is a little bit of overripeness due to some earlier ripening varieties like Pinot Blanc or Traminer, for example. There is some underripeness due to some later ripening varieties like Riesling or Welsh Riesling or Zierfandler. Of course, there are also varieties that are right in between or maybe perfect from the ripeness. But this overripeness and underripeness, that together, that gives a distinct style of wine. The overripeness gives more these exotic flavors, a little bit towards maracuja and lychee. And the underripeness gives flavors from, spiciness, freshness, acidity comes up stronger, brings the alcohol back down to a regular limit. And this, everything together, harvested at the same time, at the same day, co-processed, pressed with one press.
So all fermented together.
Co-fermented, everything together. That gives a distinct style of wine where, in my opinion, the varietal character of each of the varieties steps one step back, and the terroir, which is not just the soil, it's also the microclimate and even more than these things, that steps into the front.
As a translator of that, do you approach that differently than the single varietal wines that you also make? Is it a different mindset to say, okay, we're going to do a co-ferment with a bunch of different grape varieties, some of which I may not know what they are, versus I know the characteristics of this grape, and so I'm going to do this. Is that a different process for you?
Actually, not.
No.
No, it's just more difficult to find the perfect date of picking because the overripeness may not be too overripe towards botrytis, and the underripeness shouldn't be unripeness.
I see.
If it's unripe, then it's greenish, then it's green tannins, and this is, even if it's just a little bit, not what I want. I want more fresh fruit, I want spiciness, I want acidity from this underripeness, but I don't want greenish elements. This is not my goal.
Because they would probably accentuate each other at that high of an acidity. Like, yeah. It would taste really bitter if it had some bitterness, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how does a wine like the Nussberg Alter Reben, how does it age and how does it change over time, that blend from old vines?
That's an interesting wine because it does very well with aging. It even needs a lot more aging than most of my other wines. It's also one of the wines I bottle very late. It's always bottled either in front of the next vintage or even after the next vintage, because I see that the aromas in the winter and the spring after harvest are not the aromas I'm looking for. The aromas I'm looking for, they usually develop over the summertime and right before the next harvest. And that gets even more intense the later we bottle it. Some year you can bottle earlier, some year I bottle later. It depends a little bit on the vintage, on the acidity, on the maturity. And then once it's bottled, I again see that the wine does not show everything immediately. It needs half a year, a year, a minimum after bottling to start slowly to open up really good. It starts to be 3 years after bottling, 4 years after bottling. This is the time I would recommend for this wine. And 3-4 years is just the beginning. It's not the end. The end is, I don't know, I actually don't know where the end is. This is also a question of the aging conditions. If you have a proper wine cellar with good temperature, the low temperature, then it's probably decades. I am not sure how long it really can age, because the oldest I made is from 1999, and that is still a great bottle of wine. But I have a very good cellar for that. It might also be that somewhere in Singapore the wine is not that great anymore, because it's aged at under too warm conditions.
So you decided to do that in 99. What led you to that decision to make that wine?
Actually, I didn't want to make gemischter Satz. I wanted to have a piece of this famous Nussberg. I'm not from the Nussberg. I'm originally from the other side of the Danube, which was historically always a poor region. And the rich winemakers, they lived around the Nussberg. Over centuries, these wines were very expensive and well known over, let's say, half Europe. Due to the Danube, which was a transport possibility, it was exported in many countries, and they made a lot of money with their wine from the Nussberg. And I thought, what was good 100 years ago or 200 years ago cannot be bad today, not in the wine business, I mean not in the wine growing business. So I want to explore this mystic thing, or this glory of the Nussberg, and I want to have a piece of land there to try it out. And suddenly in 99 I heard about a vineyard, and I was able to get it, to take it over. It's still owned by a monastery. I discussed with them, and immediately they said, yes, you are the right one, you get it. But the problem was, in my eyes, in the first moment, it was a gemischter Satz. I did not believe in that in 1999. So it looked very good. It looked very healthy, and no reason to interplant anything. This was a perfect, wonderful vineyard, and already more than 40 years old at that time. So I said, let's try it at least once, and maybe we do some research. We harvest out of this field blend vineyard a few wines separated and do some varietal portions in a small quantity, just to see how the wine tastes. And the big rest goes into a big tank, and we make this gemischter Satz, and let's see how it tastes. Then after we know how it tastes, we will decide what we do with it. Okay, we did so. We harvested a little bit of Grüner Veltliner separated. We harvested some Welsh Riesling separated and some Pinot Blanc separated. Only a couple hundred kilograms out of 4 hectares. This is a big vineyard. And the big rest we put in one tank, and that was the gemischter Satz. So after fermentation, I tasted that. The Welsh Riesling was nice. Not great, but nice. The Grüner Veltliner was, wow, was really good. Very creamy, different style to what I knew from my area on the other side of the Danube. The Pinot Blanc was even greater. A fantastic Pinot Blanc, reminded me more to Alsatian Pinot Blancs. Very classy and really great. I liked it very much. And then I went to this tank with the rest, the gemischter Satz, not really believing that there could come out something interesting. And I went to this valve and filled my glass and smelled into this wine and tasted it. And this was wow. I was amazed. In this moment, I remembered that some of my old colleagues always wanted to convince me on gemischter Satz, because they said, this is our identity, this is our history, you have to respect this, and this is so great. I didn't believe it. With this first impression of that vineyard, I realized that they were right. For me, it was like Meursault without oak. Extremely terroir-driven. This chalkiness on the palates, also the intense fruit in the nose, a fantastic wine. In this moment, I knew gemischter Satz can be a great wine, and I have a raw diamond in my hand. And now well, what will we do with it? Nobody awaits for a gemischter Satz. It had at that time a very bad reputation, and I was afraid that nobody would understand it, this type of wine. But on the other side, I thought, a good wine always finds the consumers. I just have to bottle it and to show the wine to the people. And yeah, so I did, and it was successful. Maybe not perfectly successful from the first day, but this style, this was for sure the wine that pushed away that avalanche that we call today the Renaissance of the Wiener Gemischter Satz. And in the meantime, it's not just mine. This is a more than 2-3 handful, even more great Wiener Gemischter Satz wines from the Vienna region, from at least more than half a dozen of wine growers. It is, in the meantime, a Presidio product of Slow Food International. And starting with the vintage 2013, we even got our own appellation. And of course, it's the Wiener Gemischter Satz. And everybody today is very proud of it. And 15 years ago, it had a reputation like, I don't know, as a really bad.
So Wiener Gemischter Satz means it's a Vienna wine, Wiener Vienna. And why do you think in Vienna this was something that historically happened? Why did they do this, make this kind of wine?
It did not just happen in Vienna, it happened all over Europe. Yeah, before the phylloxera came, there didn't nurseries for plants exist. And the winemakers, no matter in what area in Europe, in the east, in the west, in France, in Bulgaria, everywhere, they produced their own grapes, their own vines, and they didn't care about the variety. All everybody cared always about was the appellation, the vineyards, the crews. And then the phylloxera came, and it developed more and more towards single varietal vineyards, especially in the mid of the 20th century. It became modern to have a single varietal vineyard, because this is more intelligent, everything flowers at the same time. You want to be modern, so you have to plant a single varietal vineyard. The reason why in Vienna are still so many old vineyards from Gemischter Satz is simply that the vineyards didn't get replanted or kicked out as long as they were healthy and yielding good, because the wine was not sold as a varietal wine. The wine was not sold as a Gemischter Satz either. The wine was just sold as Wiener Heuriger, and nobody asked what variety is this. In other wine regions, not only in Austria, people started to ask what variety is this. The New World showed us how important this is. The New World always went in direction of varieties and not the terroir. And that was the reason why, or is the reason why, there are still so many vineyards in Vienna, because everything that was yielding well and was tasting good stayed, because the fact that it was Gemischter Satz was not interesting for anybody.
Do you make the Nussberg Alter Reben every year? Is that a wine you make every single year?
Yes, I produce it every year, but it's quite different between the warmer years and the cooler years. 11 and 12, the last vintages were pretty warm, so it's a very powerful wine that needs a long time. It's more wines that taste a little bit like I don't know, white Bordeaux.
Yeah, that's what I think. Sometimes it's got a little oiliness to it, right, that I almost don't associate with Austria. Yeah, Austrian wines that I know. Yeah. The texture is different for me.
In the cooler years, it's clearer to define as an Austrian wine, because the fruit intensity is much stronger, and there is also the acidity. You can feel more intense. The hotter years, especially these summers, if they are hot, then the acidity goes down, the maturity goes up to a very high level. We cannot harvest too early either, because then we get more bitterness, we get more greenish unripeness, so we have to harvest a little later. We end up having a warmer wine, a wine that is more or richer in alcohol. I cannot change that, so it's always will be a very good picture of the vintage, this style of wine.
What are other standout vintages for you since 99? Which others of that wine have you thought, wow, interesting?
I liked very much the 2002 and extremely the 2004, which was a cooler vintage. And also the 2008 was also cooler vintage. But there are also warm vintage like 06 and 09 I liked extremely much. The youngest vintages I never liked. So I'm not talking about 11, 12 now that much because they are too young, to be honest. It's another year, another 2 years maybe. You have to give them to develop in the right way. And then I think the wine will show the way we expect it.
Say you pull a bottle out of your cellar of the Neusburg Alte Reben and you want to have it with dinner. Mm-hmm. How do you handle it and what would you eat with it? Would you decant it or would you drink it straight from the bottle? Would you open it in advance or would you open it and pour it right away to be drunk? And then what do you usually pair it with?
Also decant it is a question of the vintage. The older and cooler I would not decant. Maybe also not open before, maybe not serve too cold, a little more moderate temperature, maybe even above 10 degrees Celsius would be nice. The younger vintages, like 11 or 12, I would decant, actually. If I know I drink the bottle, I would decant it. What I eat to that? It's never a light wine, so for me it's a very good company to classic Viennese cuisine. I like to see it, for example, with Zwiebelrostbraten. I don't know how to translate that. It's a beef well done with this onion sauce and baked onion on top of it. So the sauce is a little sweetish. Red wine, the tannins wouldn't match well. Potatoes to it, like French fried or this in oil made, and that would fit well with this wine. Anything that needs a more powerful white wine, that goes. Not an elegant fish dish or things like that. Not a light summer chicken salad. This is not the dish for this wine. You can go towards fish when you think about spiciness, when you think also Hungarian influence, like a Hungarian, the zander, fogos, it's in Hungarian called, I don't know the English word, with lots of paprika, more intense spices, that would work. Or Asian spices to either fish or meat, that also goes pretty well with that wine.
And what about the reds? What sort of reds do you make and what's it like to make them?
When I graduated winemaking college, I had the big dream that when I start immediately to work at home, I never see anything of the world. And over centuries, it was always used for the young to go out and learn a little bit and then come back and do their profession. And I thought, I also want to do that. And I went half a year to California, to Napa Valley, and I worked there in a winery. And maybe I didn't learn a lot by the technique, because the technique in the college, I learned the same, and there was nothing in addition to that. But the philosophy, how to make wine, the goal, what is a good wine, what is a great wine, these things I learned a lot additionally to what I knew already. Austria at that time was on its own. This was a closed market and everybody was proud of its Grüner Veltliner and everybody was proud of its Zweigelt, our main red wine variety, but no French oak, no malolactic fermentation, no any other influences were allowed because this was a different taste. We don't want that, no matter if it's good or not. And I came to California and saw that also other influences can make a very good wine, even maybe a better one. In case of red wine, immediately I realized that red wine without any oak is not as good as with some oak. Of course, I also had plenty of over-oaked wines, which I also didn't like and still don't like. But to go more open to this, I actually learned when I was there. And I came back and I knew I don't want only to produce what my father did. On the one side, of course, I want to change a little bit because I want to show him that I also can make good quality. And in terms of red wine, when I came back from California, I knew very strong inside me that I want to have red wine in our list, even in fact that it is not that easy because it's a cooler climate and red wine was not so strong at that time, but I want it. So I did it, and we planted some Merlot, we planted some Cabernet Sauvignon, we planted a lot of Zweigelt, and I made my research, I imported French oak barrels and put small parts in these barrels and made my experiments, and so I built up some red wines. The one I'm not talking about so far, but which is actually the most important for me, not just today, that is Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir already my grandfather had planted, and I liked the taste of that very much, even in fact that there was no, there was big barrels, old Austrian oak, so there was no influence of oak, but Pinot Noir doesn't need that much of influence of oak, so in the warmer vintages I liked it very much, in the cooler, it was usually sold as a table wine at the Heuriger, so I didn't think about that too much, but what was interesting for me after I started at home with the winemaking, always in the winter time, I traveled like a couple of weeks to South Africa or a little bit to Australia or here and there, California, of course, back and forwards. And once we had wine tastings with the winemakers, we tasted the program, we talked about Riesling, we talked about Chardonnay. At the end of the tasting with the winemakers, it always was about Pinot Noir. This was where the eyes of any winemaker got wet. This was the most emotional issue for any winemaker I got to know. And I realized that we in Vienna, or maybe in Austria, but especially in Vienna, have actually very good conditions for that. We maybe are not the big Burgundy market in Austria, but a Pinot Noir that tastes in that direction has wonderful conditions because we have a cooler climate, we have a lot of chalk in our soil, and we have a lot of wind due to the Danube River that keeps the Pinot Noir healthy, which is not that easy under not so warm conditions. So actually the perfect conditions. And so I concentrated more and more on Pinot Noir.
And what have the results been over the years?
In the beginning, it was a little more Austrian German style, a little over fruity. The oak was maybe not as good as this was later on. And structure wise, I was not able to build up the structure in the way I wanted it. I knew the taste I wanted to create, but I didn't know how to get there. And later when I started with cold maceration and started to ferment also the stems or parts of the stems with the must, I gained suddenly that structure, what I was missing. And also the vineyard I took in another region at the Nussberg, that also was very positive for the development of my Pinot Noirs. Today, the Pinot Noirs are my top red wines, and also from the quantity, it's not that little anymore. In total, the red wine in my winery is about one third of the production. So everybody talks about white wine region Vienna, and historically this is really correct. But nowadays it's not that little red wine anymore. Maybe it's not growing anymore because it's somewhere on a roof and the Viennese are still white wine drinkers. But 35% is not so little, and well, it's not so bad, I think. And with the Pinot Noir, I think this is the right issue on the red side for the future. I think it's not Cabernet Sauvignon and that. The other wine I'm doing is the Wiener Trilogy, Vienna Trilogy, where I try to produce a typical red wine out of the region, out of a region where red wine never was typical. So Zweigelt is the base, which gives the spiciness and the cherry type flavors. And Merlot and Cabernet Sauvignon, but not that much anymore from the quantity, give it the structure and a little bit more the volume. So this is also very successful, but this is not a big wine. This is a great wine to drink, a great wine to pair with food, and a typical wine for our region. This is absolutely the case. If we talk about high quality, then it is about Pinot Noir.
What about the Neusberg vineyard again? Because you're making white from there and you're making red from there. What are the characteristics that you see in those two interpretations of that place?
I can explain that pretty good with the Pinot Noir vineyard. When I took over that vineyard, I was actually completely unhappy because it tasted very powerful and fat, like a New World Pinot Noir. I thought, oh God, what do I have here now? This is not what I want. But then I found out that it would be possible to blend it with my other vineyards that have this intense fruit. And I give a little bit more volume to that fruity batches. And I created a much better Pinot Noir after that. So this is the major difference between these two vineyard sites. All the wines at the Neusberg, because the content of clay is higher, I think that's the number one influence, are a little lower in acidity, are a little creamier and a little darker in the aromas. And in the north of the city, the soil is less, very sandy, light soil. The aromas are much lighter, acidity is higher, and there is much more freshness to the fruit. Neusberg is never this freshness. Neusberg is more about the secondary fruit that develops in the tank, in the barrel, over the time, maybe also in the bottle, not so much in the vineyard.
How about the dessert wines or the sweet wines that you make?
I always made sweet wines. My father always made sweet wines, not on purpose. This was always in years where it happened. Then you have to, or we are used to select the healthy fruit away and do our dry wines. And then you have parts that are botrytis. We left that always on the vines and came maybe a week or maybe 2 weeks later in the same vineyard. And then we harvested these botrytis dried grapes. We did that near the winery at the Biesenberg, mainly with Pinot Blanc, Chardonnay, Welsh Riesling. As well, we do it with gemischter Satz on the other side at the Neusberg, which is also working out extremely good. There's gemischter Satz where there's a wine of Neuburger that is very strong affected by botrytis. And the next wines maybe are Grüner Veltliner, there is nothing. So you'd leave just those grapes where one third of the grape is already botrytis. You leave on the vine and don't pick it. And a week later, we come back and then probably the whole grape is botrytis because it's growing quick if it's warm enough in early October. And we can make botrytis wines. Acidity is usually high because it's acid-rich varieties. Pinot Blanc has high acidity. Neuburger not so, but Welsh Riesling has high acidity. Chardonnay has high acidity. This is all variety that have higher acidity. The acidity content paired with the high sugar content gives a very intense fruit play from the nose to the palate. Wonderful wines. It's great to have that, but it does not grow every year. And since I converted to biodynamic work, it's almost impossible because all the work is against the botrytis.
You spoke about, in a way, circling back to some of the methods of your father, but at the same time, you've expanded the production into many different areas that are quite interesting on their own. You're approaching 50. What about the next generation? What do you see happening later?
Well, I just finished the building of a new facility, which was my dream to have that one day. and we made it. And I'm still not 50, and I already made it. I'm very proud on that. I just hope that I also can refinance that in time. But I think I can do that because we figured out very good and exact how to do everything. The biggest wish that is still in front of me is that this goes into the next generation. I have three kids. They are small right now. The boy is the youngest. He is 9, or he's turning 9 in May, and two girls with 10 and 12. And really, to be honest, the biggest wish I have is that this goes into the next generation. And I don't care if it's a girl, if it's a boy, if it's all of them or just one of them. I just don't want to see this getting closed one day. I don't want to see having fights about any money that could be somewhere, I don't know where. I've seen too many wineries closing down because the next generations don't want to work that much or don't see a sense in this job or different other things. Also, when the young get married and there is suddenly a son-in-law that doesn't agree with some decisions, I don't know. I just really hope that we can make it, that we convince our children to consider, to think about taking this over. We will not force them, but I really strongly hope that it happens. We try to live with them this life. I mean, we take them with us to the restaurants, we take them with us to nice resorts where we do winemaking dinners. They help a lot during tastings, pouring wine, bringing away the glasses. I give them little tips that they are happy. They help me during the harvest, bring me some food and washing containers and washing buckets and stuff like that. I try to have them a little bit live with me, with us, this life, hoping that they like it that much that they don't think of making anything else because it's the most beautiful job in the world.
And what does your brother do?
My brother took over the restaurant, the Heuriger. He learned the restaurant business and he is also a chef. And in his wild early days, he ran some nightclubs. And then he started to think about the family. And then he came down to the family business and took over the Heuriger. And he is now running the Heuriger, which is still very successful. It's 5 minutes from the winery away, also in Stammersdorf, in the north of Vienna. It's very authentic and it's very high in quality. It's inexpensive. It's very original, like Liptauer and Schweinsbraten and chicken and salads and cream cheeses for putting on the bread and stuff like that. But everything is from very high quality standards, and therefore he's also very, very successful. And he's selling my wine. So this is a wonderful combination, because when at nighttime my winery is closed, people can go to the Heuriger, taste the same wine, taste them for the same price, buy them for the same price.
Dance on the tables.
Dance on the tables.
Till 2 a.m. You know?
So it's a great combination, and it's also a lot of fun. It's great to see that a family thing works. It's not about making money all the time. It's about helping each other. It's about success. And one day I help my brother, and the other day my brother helps me. This is no discussion, and this is a great feeling. This is some of the important things of life, I think, that it is not always just about money.
Fritz Weiniger, he has made it, and he hopes to make it in the future with the Weiniger family in Vienna. Thank you very much, sir.
My pleasure.
Fritz Weiniger of the Weiniger Winery.
Hey guys, it's Talitha from Vine Wine. 750 has been the greatest revolution to wine buying in the last 10 years. The ability to be able to go online, search out one item, a Palo Cortado, a new cider, some Chinon, and have all of the answers and the great bottles in front of you in 2 seconds is something that has changed my life. Makes buying easier. I'm able to create lists late at night of wines that I've just tasted that I want to buy later. I'm able to search out wines from new importers that I've never even heard of. I'm able to find crazy stuff from Czechoslovakia that I didn't even know I wanted. You should be on 750. It's the way to be.
The big news for the podcast in 2014, retail partnership, my friend. The wines we care about from the folks who are on the show offered to you by the excellent team at Vine Wine. Go to vine-wine.com for more information about what we're up to and to find the wines. That's vine-wine.com. Check it out. Cheers.
And that's our show today. Thanks for listening. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and our own dedicated website, alldrinktothatpod.com. No apostrophe.